Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. Over the last 3 months, Idle No More has transformed from the title of a Facebook page by activists opposing Canada's Bill C-45 in Saskatchewan to an Indigenous resurgence on a global scale. Deploying a range of tactics from Twitter hashtags to flash mobs, hunger strikes to mass rallies, this First Nations movement calls for decolonization, for a holistic and treaty-based sovereignty, and for environmental justice in the face of Canada's rapacious energy extraction. For many non-natives in Canada and elsewhere, all of this comes as something of a surprise. Media reports often describe the movement as spontaneous, unplanned, and largely unconnected to history. The truth, of course, is something far more interesting, complicated, and inspiring. I'm joined today by Frederick E. Hoxie, professor of history at the University of Illinois and author of several influential books in the field of Native history. Today we'll be talking about his most recent, This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made, released in 2012 by Penguin. In 8 moving chapters stretching from the years of the American Revolution to Red Power in the 1970s, Hoxie introduces us to courageous men and women who struggled to carve out a place for Native nationhood in an expanding settler state often hell-bent on their erasure. You won't find the familiar names in here, Tecumseh, Crazy Horse Geronimo, but rather a cast of lesser-known characters, James MacDonald, Sarah Winnemucca, Robert Yellowtail, who fought not with rifle or bow, but speeches, letters, lawsuits, and books. While not a backstory to the Idle No More movement, Hoxie's activists show that from the very onset of the colonial state, Native people responded in a multitude of innovative and flexible ways. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Dr. Frederick Hoxie, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm so happy you could be here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So today we'll be discussing your new book, This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made, published in 2012 by the Penguin Press. I want to just say from the outset how important your older work, A Final Promise, was in framing and shaping my master's thesis. I'm very grateful to have read it, you know, before I went into the archives. So I've been a longtime admirer of your work. But I'm also quite grateful for this wonderful new work that you've published, and I look forward to discussing its rich and fascinating material. But I'm hoping you can just start by telling us a little bit about yourself. I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with you, but why you came to write this book now?
Well, part of it is a product of teaching. About a decade ago, I left a world of academic administration. I was at the Newberry Library in Chicago, where I had been for many years, and returned to teaching and came to the University of Illinois, a big university with a wonderful history department, but with no courses in American Indian history. And I began teaching a 2-semester sequence, a survey course in Native American history and upper level, more specialized courses and so on. And right at the same time, I also was working with Neil Salisbury and David Edmonds to produce a textbook. And so I was in the kind of comprehensive mode of thinking about Native history as a field that, is offered now at the University of Illinois alongside Russian history and Japanese history and women's history and all the other slices of history. And was really thinking about how to frame that topic. The textbook was a more or less a kind of a preset exercise in the sense that there are things that need to be covered and we tried to cover them and so on. But in the aftermath of that, I got to thinking about what really sets Native history apart and how would someone frame it to a general audience. And right about that same time, I was contacted by Penguin about its new History of American Life series, and the two kind of objectives seem to coincide. Penguin's objective of wanting to produce important, they think anyway, serious books about American history, but for a general audience, and my desire to publish a comprehensive work about American history, not a textbook, not a comprehensive history, but a a big book, a book that covered a long period of time. So when I thought about those things, I was also taken back to my experiences with students over the years, and what the expectations that they come to when they come to a topic such as Native American history, or people in the general public. And my view is that what people know about American Indians is really produced by our popular culture and by our national culture, really. And that that view, which isn't really generated by Indian people, is generated by the non-Indian world, is that Indians are people who opposed American expansion, people whose most prominent leaders were warriors, and who were people of the past, people who were noble, perhaps, and brave, and admirable in many ways, but people who were really figments of the past. And, you know, there are grains of truth in many of those statements. Indians, of course, did oppose American expansion, and many great Indian leaders were warriors and so on. But what really makes American Indian history significant, that is the history of Native people inside the United States and over the course of the history of the United States, is the remarkable, I think, success, despite the many tragedies and dispossessions, the success of Native people in surviving, in finding a place within the United States, a place where Indian communities can survive, can live, can even thrive, and we can and could exist into the modern period where Native people are part of the American landscape. Native communities exist and prosper in many places, where Native rights are defended in the courts and so on. I wasn't trying to, and I don't intend to, paint a kind of sunny picture that everything is great in Indian country. But I do think that the story of how Native people came to survive in the United States has a great deal to do with the story of people I call activists, that is, Native leaders who sought to use the institutions, the language, the values that had been imposed upon them by the United States to protect their communities and to actually build a structure for Native survival and continuation and persistence into the modern period. And of course, all of that shows Native people as active agents of history, as people who are thoroughly engaged in the modern world, and people who are, as I say in the book, fellow travelers in the American journey, not exotic artifacts of the past. Mm.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised how this book, I got the distinct sense in reading this book that it is shaped as much as your role, by your role as an educator, as it is as a scholar. You actually start the book with this introduction about an exercise you do with your students on the first day of class, and I guess your Intro to Native American History course. You ask them to write down the name of three American Indians, which is quite challenging for a lot of students, right? I mean, what kind of responses does that generate?
Yeah, well, I should say that this introduction follows the original introduction of the book, which was about 40 pages long and filled with references to other authors. And the people at Penguin took one look at it and said, try again. So to your point, though, of really trying to get at what the book's ambition is, mm-hmm. is that when I ask that question, really intending to just sort of inventory what people have in their heads, the answer is always the usual suspects, Crazy Horse, Geronimo, and Sitting Bull, with Pocahontas usually taking a nipping into third place every now and then. Mm-hmm. But people of the past, people whose fame, if you want to call it that, came from their engagement with or opposition to American expansion, and people who reflect a kind of a general understanding that Native history was short and sad and is over. And so the book's ambition is to try to paint a different kind of picture that contrasts with that of people who had long commitments, people who are deeply engaged in the modern project and in the American national project, and who existed and surfaced over many parts of the country.
I have to say this, I was a bit surprised to read the epigraph of this book, this quote by Adam Smith, who actually makes it a pretty incredibly trenchant criticism of European colonialism. Maybe it's a bit of a tangent, but why open with Adam Smith, this kind of amazing and surprising quote?
Well, amazing and surprising is kind of what I was hoping for, so I appreciate that, Andrew.
Yeah.
I think you're the first person who's mentioned that to me. I came across this. I can't remember what I was doing reading Adam Smith, but I just thought, wow, this is, you know, Adam Smith is one of those characters that we kind of caricature.
Sure.
You know, we don't really think of him, at least people who aren't in the field of economic theory and so on don't take him very seriously, I think, as a three-dimensional person. I thought, what a really insightful statement. And it really, and I guess the other reason, so it's surprising. It also shows that, you know, this is not a story whose ending has yet been written, and not a story that certainly Adam Smith thought was over. The history of Native people was not finished as far as Adam Smith was concerned. This was part of a long process of European expansion, colonialism, dispossession, and resistance to dispossession. And I thought the open-endedness of that quotation was really striking. And it evoked a lot of the ideas that I hoped to stimulate in the book. And one of them was just surprise. And I think all of the characters in my book are surprising in the sense that they're people, in a sense, who weren't supposed to be there. People who were unexpected and remarkably original and inventive in their time.
So maybe you could talk a bit about the process you went through in selecting whose stories you would highlight here. I mean, you mentioned a little bit how you weren't necessarily looking for people who physically resisted American empire, but you make the distinction that even if people didn't physically resist U.S. expansion, they never necessarily surrendered to it.
Right.
What is that distinction, and how did you come to these characters that you highlighted?
I spent a long time. I couldn't tell you, but it was this book gestated for a long time before I actually started writing it. And I sort of began composing a kind of all-star team of political activists. I thought, well, you know, who's really a remarkable political activist. One of the figures is Sarah Winnemucca, who I have taught many times in various courses. Her autobiography, Life Among the Paiutes, is just one of the great books in American literature. So there were people who kind of jumped out at me. But then as I began to sort of think about them, I wanted to begin, again, because the book, one of the initial ideas behind the book was to reach a general audience. I thought the best way to do that was not a narrative of policy questions or a narrative of land issues or built around an abstract question, but really a narrative that was built around individual lives, about people who were human, that had doubts, that had ambitions that weren't realized, that failed, but that also had friends and networks and families and influences beyond their own time and so on. And so I kind of arranged them chronologically. And over time, the figures began to sort of fall into place. So I begin with James McDonald, the first Indian lawyer. As far as I know, the first Native American to be trained as a lawyer in the 1820s he was trained in Ohio, but he practiced in Mississippi. He essentially worked for a brief time as a tribal attorney. And I ended with Vine Deloria, who I think is a remarkable character, who died just as I was beginning to write this book and was a good friend and someone who I thought embodied a lot of the ideas that I wanted to get to. I had Sarah Winnemucca. Thomas Sloan has always fascinated me, a lawyer who practiced in Washington in the early 20th century. I kind of pieced them together. And we can talk more about this perhaps down the line. But one of the things that really I found amazing as I began to not just assemble a list of names, but began to actually work on them and write, was the many connections I found among them. So they're meant to be real people and they're real actors. And I've tried to show them in three dimensions. But they're also quite representative of particular moments in this progression of activism and the emergence of political activism.
So while these characters don't necessarily emerge from the tradition of martial resistance, they also don't fit into familiar narratives of civil rights, per se. You write that this is not a simple story of linear progression and a triumph and a climatic court decision or legislative victory. How do you think these stories you tell here buck the common understandings of that we have might have of, for instance, the advancement of political rights for African Americans in that divide between sort of militancy and civil rights advancement, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, I think it's many years ago, I was an admirer of Richard Kluger's book, Simple Justice. And it was a story of Brown. It's a long, dramatic narrative of the Brown case and how it came to be and so on. And for a long time, I thought, gee, it'd be nice if there were a Native American Brown. Then, of course, you ask the question, why isn't there a Native American Brown? Well, because we're talking about a much more complex situation. We're talking about people resisting colonialism, about group rights, about treaty rights, about cultural rights, about people from a different cultural tradition than the American mainstream. And so while there's overlap, there's a lot of difference and divergence. It's one of the reasons why I saw Vine Deloria as my anchor in the modern period, because, of course, one of the things that Deloria was most outspoken about early in his career was that during the 1960s, with the height of the civil rights movement, where he said Native American rights are not the same as African American rights, and Native people have a different agenda than African Americans and Latinos and other minority groups. It's not just a civil rights movement. And so I also was very clear in my mind as I tried to write this. I'm not sure if it works everywhere, but that the agenda was always more than just a change in the law or a change in some particular, short-term victory. And I think that's really an important thing to always keep in mind in Native history, is that we're talking ultimately about a incongruous relationship, about what is essentially a colonial relationship between the United States and American Indian people who were not present at the creation, who did not consent to the U.S. Constitution, and who were dispossessed by the creation of the United States, and yet who live and prosper and have allegiance to the United States. It's a paradox, but it's a fundamental fact of Native American existence.
I also wanted to ask, as sort of a broader framing question, there seems to be a concern, obviously, in the book with place. I mean, the title is This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. And then, of course, your first chapter is titled Erased from the Map. Maybe talk a bit about the title, why you went with The Place They Made, and what are the sort of spatial or sort of place elements of this work?
That's also a really good question, and I'm not sure how well I can answer it, except to say that Chapter 1, Erased from the Map, really began as a short introduction and evolved into a much bigger story, because the United States was founded on the assumption that Native people did not exist. And I wanted to make that clear, that people, literally societies, were erased from the map. So the first chapter is about the aftermath of the American Revolution and this absolutely outrageous American ambition to have the western boundary of a new country at the Mississippi River. The Spanish were horrified at this idea. The French were kind of perplexed, and the Americans insisted on it. And because of the convolutions of diplomatic life in Paris in 1782 and 3, they were able to win the agreement of the British to this western boundary. But the effect of it was to assert American sovereignty and control over an area, you know, 80% of which or more was Indian country. This is the predicament Indian people find themselves in the early 19th century. This country has been created, and there is no place for them in it. They are living in it, but there is no legal conceptual place for them in it. And the victory of these people is that they create that place. They create a legal place. They create a conceptual place. They create a way of living in a country that was founded on their dispossession.
Wow. Yeah. I guess that's a segue of sorts into this first chapter. We won't have time to discuss all of the characters here, but which is all the better, because I do hope people go out and pick up a copy of this fine book and get to all the other characters. But I just want to spend a moment with Joseph Brandt and Alexander McGillivray. I guess more broadly, I mean, is there any a very effective chapter in a lot of ways? And I'm just wondering if there's any other way to read the American Revolution from a Native perspective other than as a tragedy of sorts, which is sort of my, I guess, my bigger question. But more particularly, why did you pick Brandt and McGillivray to get at this crisis in the American Revolution period for Indian people?
Well, the part of the story, too, is that the founding of the United States marks a dramatic shift in the political, not so much the day-to-day reality, because, you know, sovereignty, where I'm sitting now in central Illinois, the shift of sovereignty to the United States didn't mean a whole lot in 1783 or 4 or 5. But conceptually and politically and legally, it was a dramatic many authors have written about this. Dan Richter does very well in the ending sections of his Facing East book, and certainly Colin Calloway's book on the Revolution, that an older style of imperial diplomacy and imperial politics, in which Indians played important military and diplomatic roles, was ended, and a new national regime was created. And both McGillivray and Brandt were products of that older style, that older era. They both served in the British Army. They were both officers. They were both respected allies of the British. They fought alongside British soldiers. They expected, they had the tacit recognition of the British as independent sovereigns, as independent leaders. When Joseph Brandt heard the terms of the Paris Peace Treaty when he was at Fort Niagara in the spring of 1783, he couldn't believe it. And he went straight to Quebec to talk to the British commander. He said, what's going on here? And the British commander had no answer for him. So I used them in that chapter to show how their world was literally being swept away by this shift in political reality.
Hmm. Now, I was familiar before this book, rather, I should say, with Brandt and McGillivray, but I was actually completely unaware of James McDonald. You mentioned him a little bit earlier in the interview. A Choctaw who is, for all intents and purposes, the first Indian lawyer. McDonald comes to the fore in the removal crisis that faced not only the Choctaws, but every Native nation in the Southeast. You write that the Choctaws realized what they needed in this particular moment, in this particular conflict with the United States, was not necessarily a charismatic chief, but a lawyer. How did that come to be? And you know, what's going on in that moment for the Choctaws that a character like James McDonald becomes so important?
Well, in some ways, McDonald's experience and the Choctaws' experience recapitulates what I just said about McGillivray and Brandt, in that the Choctaws, having been comrades in arms with Andrew Jackson during the Battle of New Orleans, having been signatories to treaties with the United States in the aftermath of the American Revolution, thought of themselves as permanent residents of the Southeast, sovereign neighbors to the white settler communities and so on. They had prosperous cattle industry and a whole range of things going on. Suddenly, in 1819, president's representative, Andrew Jackson, this politician from Tennessee, comes to a treaty council and begins to insist that their time in the Southeast is over and that they must move west. The people he was negotiating with, many of them were people who had actually fought with Jackson, who wore American military uniforms, and he would hear none of it. He was essentially saying to them that alliance, which was a kind of a holdover from the pre-revolutionary days, that alliance is over. We are making the laws now, and there's no place here. Again, place. There's no place here for you. And in their struggle to kind of come to terms with this, they turn to this young man who has just returned from the East, who has been trained as a lawyer, and they take him with them to Washington, D.C., where he serves, as many young men did both then and later, as a kind of interpreter and clerk to the elders, the chiefs who were there. But what was really remarkable about James McDonald is that he went to Washington with these elders, Pushmataha, the famous Choctaw leader who was the leader of the delegation. And, you know, I said they needed a lawyer. I didn't say they hired a lawyer, because I'm not sure exactly what was in their minds, but they saw him as a valuable asset. And they began using him as a – he recorded the negotiations. He wrote proposals to the Secretary of War. He critiqued the proposals that came back. In other words, this was really being – and I again, I think pretty much for the first time, this was being conducted as a literate negotiation. This was not ceremonial. This was not people sitting across a treaty fire. This were people in different offices writing out proposals and passing them back and forth. And so this really marks a dramatic shift in the way treaties were negotiated. But then the other thing about McDonald, which I think is really quite remarkable, is that many people know the story that Pushmataha dies in the middle of these negotiations. He gets an infectious disease in the winter. And McDonald is, in effect, the leader of the delegation after this. It's a number of lesser chiefs and young men and so on. And they negotiate the treaty. But then the other thing that happens that's really quite remarkable is that McDonald writes a memorial to Congress as they're leaving Washington in early 1825. And in this memorial to Congress, which is very brief, I really sort of argue this is the kind of the foundation stone of federal Indian law, because what they say in this memorial is, you are a nation of laws, and because you are a nation of laws, you will protect our rights. Mm. They're really saying we have treaties with you, and because you're committed to legal relationships, you are the one who are going to guarantee our rights, that we actually have a bond here that ensures us certain protections. And it's a remarkable kind of lawyerly judo move, in a sense, that makes the United States suddenly the guarantor, at least rhetorically, of Indian rights. And this is what treaty rights are all about. Now, treaty rights are something that it's a concept that we're very comfortable with in the 21st century. This was not something that had been envisioned by the founding fathers. And it's really McDonald who, I think, begins the process of articulating what that means. So it's, you know, again, it's, I don't want to make too much of him. He was a very small character at a tiny moment, but he's very, very early. It's before the Cherokee crisis really hits. And it's one that really shows the inventiveness and the agency and the creativity of an Indian activist, and literally making a place for his people in that way.
You know, it's easy to look back at the removal crisis as Indian removal more broadly as something that was inevitable, that, you know, it was just this long march of the U.S. West. I mean, do you think that there was a possibility to fundamentally change? I mean, was the U.S. negotiating in good faith in these moments, I guess, is my question, in the sense that, you know, could have negotiations more broadly change the dynamic? And I guess they did to a large degree, but I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always say to students that if things are inevitable, we're all out of work. So, you know, the historians are out of business.
Right,
so
right.
I reject the inevitability of all of this just broadly. But what someone like McDonald demonstrates is both how the rules of the game were being changed. This wasn't happening automatically. It wasn't just a matter of brute strength. In the end, of course, it was brute numbers and strength that made the day. But the process by which it occurred created a kind of political consciousness among Choctaw leaders. You might say just among elites, but I think you could say beyond just a few people, a kind of political consciousness of the Choctaws and of other groups as political actors with certain claims on the United States. And also they give the lie to Jackson's fundamental point, which is that American Indians are backward people, mm-hmm. And cannot live in a modern world. They were completely at home in this relationship and in this negotiation. They were perfectly prepared to negotiate some kind of way of living with the American nation state. And you know, yes, they fail. McDonald dies. The Choctaws are removed. And yet, and I don't want to just repeat chapter after chapter here, but the I think the removal, as tragic as it was, really starts a process of legal reflection on the part of Native leaders. And so in the middle of the 19th century, when I my next chapter is William Potter Ross and the Cherokee leaders of the second half of the 19th century, who really articulate a kind of full-blown idea of Native American nationalism and of nationalism coexisting with American nationalism. It's really a very much a continuous process or a continuous thread from McDonald into those leaders of the late 19th century. And that's an example of what I was saying earlier about sort of picking these people and thinking about these as different moments. And yet, as I got into them, seeing the connections really between them.
So jumping ahead a bit, another character I have to admit I hadn't heard of before was Sarah Winnemucca. I hope I'm pronouncing that in the ballpark.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, with Sarah Winnemucca, who, as you mentioned earlier, published a very important book, the first Native American woman to have a book published in the United States. Just, I'm hoping you could talk a little bit about Sarah Winnemucca and introduce her to the audience.
Sarah Winnemucca grew up, was born literally in the middle of what's now I-80 running into California. It was the California Trail. It was the trail that the gold prospectors followed. And living on the border, the California-Nevada border, with her Paiute family and so on, she witnessed firsthand the onslaught of American settlement in California. And what was remarkable about her is that she learned English very early. Her father and grandfather were leaders of the Paiute bands that were on the eastern slope of the Sierras there. And she was around white people. Her father and grandfather were kind of tribal leaders who attempted to sort of negotiate agreements with the Americans and so on. And she saw things fall apart. And she became an interpreter. So she gained increasing fluency and command of English, and in the course of this, she witnessed the daily kind of violation of treaty rules, violation of reservation boundaries, violence against Indian people in general, against Indian women in particular, and she goes on the lecture circuit. In the 1870s, and begins speaking out against American expansion. This is, of course, in the time of the beginning of the Indian rights movement and the humanitarian reformers of the late 19th century and so on. So she begins kind of in that vein, but she really has a remarkable voice. And people use the phrase speak truth to power today all the time. She's really an example of someone who did that. And so in her autobiography, which I should just step back and say that she was on the lecture circuit and then she made contact with white women reformers, people who were involved in the Indian rights movement, but other women's rights movements and so on. And two of these people in Boston sort of took her in and encouraged her to take her lectures, basically, and turn them into an autobiography. So Life Among the Paiutes is an autobiography of her career, but it's written in this dramatic, very modern voice, where it's a kind of a testimony to the costs of American expansion. So at a time when Americans are celebrating the westward movement and the conquest of the West, and they're painting those wall-sized paintings of the Sierra Mountains and Sierra Nevada Mountains and all of that, Sarah Winnemucca writes, "The Americans came into my country like a lion," she says. So she has this image of the American expansion, not as noble settlers, Daniel Boone-type characters, but as a lion, you know, that is roaring lion, she says. And so she talks about the dark side of American expansion and the immorality of it and so on. And it's just a remarkable voice. And I thought I wanted to write about her because she isn't, I think, well understood. She's been mischaracterized, I think, by a lot of people. But also because she makes the point that the activist, one element of the activist critique of the United States wasn't just kind of legal and political, but it was also sort of moral and rhetorical, sort of challenging the idea of America as a representative of democracy and of expansion and of course, of 19th century progress, you know, the great value of the 19th century. She's saying this is not progress. And the book is really written in this kind of ironic note about the civilization of the Paiutes and really about the savagery of the Americans. Hmm.
Thomas Sloan is another character that's a little bit of a later period, but I was very interested in the context of Thomas Sloan. I mean, in the one sense, he's calling for citizenship, but it's not exactly the kind that the assimilationists that you write about in A Final Promise, I mean, the white assimilationists, the people who are launching right. this campaign, which is supposed to culminate in citizenship of a type. You know, by the time you end A Final Promise in the 1920s, there is the Indian Citizenship Act. But Thomas Sloan had a different vision of sorts for where citizenship would take Indian people. Is that fair to say, you think?
Yeah, it is. I'm glad you asked it that way, because to go back to something you asked earlier, I think one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book about individual people and about their view of the world and trying to link their views of the world across time is that people take, for example, Sarah Winnemucca. One of her goals was to create protected areas for Paiute people. And she didn't care if they were small homesteads or they were large reservations, but there should be some kind of a homeland for Paiute people. Well, people have looked at her and said, well, Sarah Winnemucca believed in allotment. Well, actually, she might have signed on to some allotment laws, but she wasn't. This is not Henry Dawes. This is not someone with bad agenda. So it's really important to understand not just the perspective of these people, but the context in which they were functioning. So Thomas Sloan, the chapter is called "The Good Citizenship Gun." Thomas Sloan really adheres to the idea that citizenship can be a weapon. It can be a tool used by Indians to protect their rights. He grew up at a time when the arbitrary power of the Indian office was absolute, when, in fact, he himself was sent to Hampton Institute as punishment for exposing corruption on the reservation. Before he knew it, he was on a train to Hampton Institute in Virginia. So from his point of view, citizenship was going into court and defending the rights of Indian people to do things that the government didn't want them to do was a way of supporting treaty rights or tribal rights or group rights or cultural rights. And when he sets up his law office in Washington around the time of World War I, he becomes a kind of full-time lobbyist and lawyer for Indian groups that have come to Washington either with authorization or without it. To make their case before federal committees and so on, and he's accused by authors of being kind of an ambulance chaser and maybe kind of corrupt and so on. And I didn't find it. None of these people I think are perfect paragons of virtue. But his perspective was that he was using the law and using citizenship to defend the freedom of Indian people to engage in their lives the way they wanted to do it.
So I want to jump ahead now a few decades and just bring out the last character that we'll spend some time with, or figure, and that's Vine Deloria Jr., someone whose intellectual work I think many of our listeners are quite aware of. But you've chosen to include Deloria in a book about activism. It's not premised around intellectuals. I mean, you obviously highlight his intellectual contributions as well. But I think that not many people know of Deloria's role, for instance, in the National Congress of American Indians. So mm-hmm. Hoping you could just talk about Vine Deloria Jr., the activist.
Okay. Well, one of the things that was remarkable to me is I had heard a little bit about this because I knew some of this, but that Vine Deloria became the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians in 1964. He was 31 years old. He had almost no experience in government or in activism. But he was an ambitious, well-educated, articulate guy who came from a very important family. His father and grandfather were religious leaders in the Dakotas and famous bilingual Episcopal priests. At any rate, Deloria was well-connected but not well-experienced. He arrives in Washington, D.C. just as Lyndon Johnson is elected to his full term as president, in the same month fall season as Martin Luther King is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. This kind of high watermark of sort of liberal progressive reform and so on in the 20th century America. And he seizes on this moment by becoming a very strong advocate and architect of the idea of what's now called the War on Poverty or these War on Poverty programs, which are now largely forgotten. But what people don't realize, and what Deloria saw so clearly, was that what the War on Poverty promised was that community action groups, that community organizations originally the conception was in cities, in poor areas, or in rural areas, could organize themselves and could petition the government for money to support, whether it's a local housing project or an economic development project or an industrial park or something. And Deloria saw that this was, and others, but Deloria was quite out front in this, saw that this was a way for Native American communities to organize and to become financially supported without having to go through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to have literally self-determination on a very small local scale. And so he becomes really a kind of facilitator through the National Congress of American Indians in an array of programs where tribes organize housing authorities, they organize schools, they organize hospitals, they organize educational programs of various kinds, and they use the funding of the Office of Economic Opportunity, but other federal agencies as well, to create an actual tribal infrastructure in Native communities that can become a vehicle, a place where Native political leaders can have a voice and can have real clout, can have real power. And it's really at this point that the power of the Bureau of Indian Affairs really, it's kind of a tipping point where Native tribal leaders begin to sort of have the upper hand. I remember visiting an Indian reservation in the 1970s, and there was the Indian agent at one end of the building, and there was the tribal council at the other end of the building. And the superintendent had, I don't know, three quarters of the space in the building, and the tribal council had one quarter. It was sort of like the student council for the reservation. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a generation later, it was exactly the reverse, or more so, where the tribal council was running the schools, it was running the hospital, it was running the housing authority and all the rest of it. And it really grows, it's more than just the Office of Economic Opportunity, but it really is that exploitation of these new kinds of resources that were, of course, made available because of the civil rights movement and a bunch of other things that Deloria takes advantage of. Mm-hmm. But the other thing, just to say very quickly about Deloria, is even as he's engaged in all of this, and he was an intellectual, he's constantly kind of critiquing it at the same time, wondering, you know, are we just kind of becoming bureaucrats? Are we just mm-hmm. becoming administrators? One of the things he warned against in his writings is we want self-determination, not self-administration. We don't want to just administer programs that are just set up by somebody else. We want to actually, and he was constantly, and it's why he was often a controversial character in Indian country, because while on the one hand he was a leader that people respected and so on, he also was, especially when he returned and came to the university and became a kind of outsider to the world of activism, he loved to poke fun at Indian leaders and to point out where they were getting a little too comfortable with the government and its programs and so on.
What's his relationship to the American Indian movement when it really comes on the scene a few years after his NCAI involvement?
So that's really an interesting part of the story. And I would say it's a complex relationship. On the one hand, he said at one point that he thought, that Russell Means was one of the great Native leaders, that he admired their adherence to the wisdom of the elders in these communities, standing up for tribal culture, defying the bureaucracy and all the rest of it. But he was terribly frustrated by the fact that their rhetorical and theatrical resistance didn't have a strategy behind it. His idea was that you should be doing both things at once. You should be challenging. You should be enacting the most kind of dramatic change you can, but you should also be prepared to negotiate some kind of a solution. So Alcatraz, Wounded Knee 2, some of these other events, he on the one hand was supportive of them, but he also was critical that they didn't produce any concrete results. I'm not sure if they could have, but that was his view. And he was also frustrated by the fact that the dramatic pose, you know, the warrior pose at Wounded Knee and so on, attracted all the media attention, and the serious people who were the elected tribal leaders and others were often ignored by the mainstream media.
It's interesting you raise that. One of the things I wanted to mention at some point in the interview is, you know, it's interesting. I've spent a lot of time in activist circles, mostly white activist circles, on various sort of various political stripes. And there is some canonization or even iconography of people like Geronimo, all the way up through Russell Means. But you don't see that with the characters that you raise in this book. And, you know, I mean, those aren't the people that have been sort of canonized by non-natives who look for political inspiration for various, you know, whether it's right. environmental movements or whether it's, you know, any other kind of movement, who look and borrow and even appropriate sometimes. You don't see.
One of my hazy memories of the 1960s being an undergraduate was I had a poster of Geronimo on the wall of my dormitory room. I have absolutely no idea why I put it up. I knew nothing about Native history, but I really liked that guy holding a carbine. I thought that was great, you know. So
yeah,
I mean, it's,
right, exactly.
It's a symbolism, but it's not real. It's not, you know, it was. Sure. It wasn't even an inch deep.
Yeah, you know, and it's one of the reasons I also wanted to have you on now is there some of these debates are coming to a head with this Idle No More movement,
absolutely,
which is going on mostly among Canadian First Nations. But the other thing that connects it in some ways to this book is this unbelievable range of tactics, everything from this incredible, you know, internet messaging of the Idle No More movement. It's all over social media, to hunger strikes, to policy discussions, to direct action and civil disobedience. It seems like there are a whole range of tactics being drawn upon in much the same way that many of the characters in your book are drawing upon a range of tactics.
Right. And I think that, again, I don't mean to conflate everything together or to summarize or to be
sure.
too simplistic about it. But I do think that it goes back to the fact that this relationship is ultimately a colonial relationship. And so the resistance or the effort to find a way of living in the United States is never going to be simple and will always be subject to people who will challenge and who will disrupt what looks like a sort of a good solution at a particular time. I love the moment at the opening of the National Museum of the American Indian, which is a wonderful moment for me to be present when the doors were opened. But as they were being opened, that was 8 years ago when the museum opened, there were young Native guys passing back and forth, handing out leaflets saying, condemning the museum for not focusing on genocide as a central fact of Native American mm-hmm. life. That instability that even in this kind of, you know, august formal institutional setting of the opening of the museum, there were critics who would be, I think, very comfortable with the Idle No More and other tactics today.
Interesting. So before I let you go, I sort of just wanted to ask you one broad question. I mean, about the new Indian historiography or the historiography generally of the kind of studies that you've done, because you have played a large role in shaping this field over the past decades. And I just kind of wanted to ask you broadly if you're optimistic about the field. Where do you think it's going, or where do you think it should go, or, you know, just some thoughts along those lines.
Well, I feel like I'm a follower rather than a leader at this point. I think it's going in a number of really exciting directions. I think the existence and the growth of the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, which is now holding annual, very large and successful annual meetings, bringing together Native and non-Native scholars from all over the continent and now internationally, is reflective of that. I'm privileged to work with graduate students who are exploring topics of transnational indigenous history, of indigenous experiences in many time places, and so on. So I see this as a field that is growing, that's vibrant, and I think probably that what I would say about the where it is now is connecting increasingly with other kinds of histories, with imperial histories globally, with histories of women, histories of regions, histories of cities. That Native history is not just this little garden that is being cultivated and grown, but is actually turning into a forest that's growing and combining with other scholarly endeavors. And I think it's I think it has its own identity. It's not disappearing in the process, but it's certainly flourishing, I think, at this point.
So I've been speaking with Frederick Hoxsey, the author of the new book, This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made. It's out now from the Penguin Press. Dr. Hoxsey, as a way of ending, you've written on Federal Assimilation Program, Lewis and Clark, the Crow Nation, Indians in the Progressive Period, now this wonderful book on Indian activists. What's next?
Well, I'm very interested in this idea of Indian activism, of indigenous activism, and I'm curious to explore it beyond the boundaries of the United States at the turn of the 20th century. I think that there is an indigenous story to American empire and American imperial expansion, particularly in the Pacific, that I'm interested in trying to explore and find a way to write about. I think there were other people like these in other parts of the world, and I wonder how much they knew about each other, how much their ideas ran parallel to one another. And so I'm in some ways I feel like I'm being led by my students, but I like where they're going, and I want to try to follow along.
Well, Dr. Hoxsey, thanks so much for joining me today.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to a discussion with Frederick E. Hoxsey about his new book, This Indian Country, American Indian Activists and the Place They Made, from Penguin Press in 2012. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past interviews free of charge, or on iTunes, where you can download and subscribe to the podcast. We're also on Facebook, where you can leave comments, questions, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear on this program. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening, and support the Idle No More movement.